right, settle in. This is going to be a two-hour ride. We hope you'll stay with us for the duration, a two-hour debate. And we'll also open up the phones to you early, but I caution you, let's just sit tight and listen to the arguments before you weigh in. And I would say probably, in all honesty, we won't get to the phone calls until near the top of the hour, so about 12. All right, but in the interim, the numbers are, as per usual, 416-872-1010, StarTalk, toll-free from out of town, 1-800-561-CFRB. The issue on the table, controlled demolition. And the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center towers and, of course, Building 7. And according to this hypothesis, the towers and Building 7 were not destroyed by the planes that crashed into the towers as part of the September 11th attacks, nor by the fires that followed, but by explosives or other devices planted in the buildings in advance. The most detailed statements of the hypothesis, which has become a central theme for the members of the 9/11 Truth Movement, have come from physicist Stephen Jones, software engineer Jim Hoffman, theologian David Ray Griffin, and author Webster Griffin Tarpley, and one of my guests tonight who joins us on the line, Richard Gage, is an architect, a California-based designer of fireproofed steel-framed buildings, and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard Gage, welcome to News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's great to be here.
All right. And your worthy opponent, Richard, tonight is Ron Craig, who is a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers and the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. Welcome to News Talk 1010, Ron.
Thank you both.
Now, let me first throw it over to Richard. And I'm going to ask you to keep your statements as tight and as short as possible so we can work in as many points as we can. But Richard, if you could give us your top two or three main points as to why you are convinced that the Trade Center towers and Building 7 were brought down by controlled demolition.
Well, sure. I'd like to, just for the benefit of your listeners, though, to let everybody know that there are, in fact, millions of people in the United States and also in Canada who do believe that there is a huge problem. And I wanted to cite a poll really quickly. 2006 poll by the New York Times and CBS found that 28% of Americans believe that the Bush administration is lying, and this is not just about the events, not just about Iraq, but about the events surrounding 9/11. And of more concern is another poll by Scripps Howard Ohio University that year that found 16% believe that the Twin Towers were brought down by explosives. So this is a very serious phenomena, and that's, I know, why you're having us on the air tonight. So I wanted to provide that small degree of background, if we could, also. And, of course, it's extremely important that we understand the whole truth about 9/11 because it served as the pretext for the invasion of two countries in which already a million people have perished, and the loss of our own freedoms, of course, here at home ensued shortly thereafter. So it is extremely important that we get to we look at this painful part of our past, and that's why I'm speaking all around the country in every city I can to get these truths out. So what are the key points? One, we have chemical evidence of an incendiary in the rubble at the base of not just the two Twin Towers, but Building 7 as well. That in and of itself alone is evidence, the fingerprint left by the criminals, that can put a lot of people behind bars for a long time. In addition to that, there's plenty of explosive testimony for explosives in that the Twin Towers, everything just about inside, was blown outside the footprint and hurling beams 500 feet laterally into the buildings surrounding them, and these beams being cut to 30-foot lengths, and their ends dripping with molten metal, which we'll get into. And then the floors themselves completely disappeared into this pulverized volcanic mushroom cloud of material, which was blown almost all over downtown Manhattan and across the Hudson River too.
All right, three excellent points. Ron, did you want to make an opening statement before we get you to make your opening?
Absolutely. The World Trade Building, the World Trade Center buildings were hit by a perfect storm. They got hit by an aircraft that delivered a tremendous amount of kinetic energy to the building. That was followed by a fuel-air explosion as the gas from the tanks or the fuel from the tanks mixed with the air and exploded, and then it was hit by a fire. The buildings fell because of natural causes caused by those factors. In other words, there were no explosives used at all, and there's no scientific evidence that would lead me to believe that that's the case.
All right. Short and sweet, Ron Craig is in studio with us tonight, and he is a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers, International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators, does not believe the World Trade Center buildings and Building 7 were brought down by controlled demolition. Richard Gage is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He also is the designer of fireproofed steel-framed buildings. He believes with great certainty that they were, in fact, brought down by controlled demolition. Let me ask Iran, then. One of the points that Richard brought up was the fact that the debris was so pulverized. I mean, how can you explain that by a collision of an airliner into the building? The debris was just like powder.
Well, I agree with you. And to understand it, I think we should look at it as though we're dealing here with a fire and an explosion investigation. In other words, we want to look at motive, means, and opportunity. The motive Richard has already described, and I'm going to put that aside for a moment, because I'm really looking at the technical. How did we actually blow this building up? But there are a few things we have to understand. When that airplane crashed into the building, it delivered about three times the kinetic energy that the building was designed to take. Concrete actually disintegrates at approximately 30,000 pounds per square inch. Tremendously more energy than that was delivered to the building itself, which would have vaporized the cement in that area. That would have accounted for some of the dust. So when you start looking at exactly why these phenomena occurred, in some cases and in most cases, in fact, I believe in all cases, there's a technical explanation for it.
Richard, why don't you respond to what Ron said about the debris?
Sure. What we have is no macroscopic chunks of concrete found almost anywhere at the base of the building. And in fact, this concrete and the 20 gauge steel pans and the floor trusses and the million file cabinets that must have been in these buildings, by some estimates, were completely pulverized such that they couldn't find anything. There's no desks, there's no chairs. We're talking about dust and gravel that this concrete turned to. And Ron has suggested that the kinetic energy delivered by the airplane, it's actually irrelevant. The kinetic energy delivered by the airplane was delivered, and the building oscillated as it was designed to do and stood for 56 minutes and 102 minutes, respectively, in the South and North Towers. And the official story even suggests that the building did fine. In fact, the engineer, Skilling, said that the building was designed to take a direct hit from a 707 traveling 600 miles an hour, and the problem would be that all the fuel would dump into the building, and the building structure would still be there. So that's a quote from the lead structural engineer.
All right. Richard Gage, the founder of Architects and Engineers, stay put. Likewise, Ron Craig, who is our demolitions and... our member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers and International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators, quite a mouthful. We've got some real experts here on the program tonight, ladies and gentlemen, as we dedicate the full 2 hours to debating whether or not the Twin Towers, Building 7 of the World Trade Center complex, were brought down by controlled demolition. Get on board as well at 416-872-1010, StarTalk, toll-free from out of town, 1-800-561-CFRB. Two experts in the field of demolition and architecture and engineering debating whether the World Trade Center towers 1 and 2 and Building 7 were brought down by explosives placed inside the buildings in advance of 9/11. Richard Gage is on the line. He's an architect, a California-based designer of fireproofed steel frame buildings, and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, says they were brought down by controlled demolition. Ron Craig in studio, member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers and the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. Richard Gage, a question to you. It has often been cited that this is the first time in history that a steel frame high-rise collapsed, but I'm since reading that that's not necessarily true. And it's also the first time in history that an airliner has rammed into a steel high-rise building that's built like the two towers, a tube-in-tube design. Does that not at all undermine the argument in your mind?
No. Let's take your first assertion. There have been over 100 fires, and I mean very hot, very long-lasting, and very large fires in steel-framed high-rise buildings, and not one of them has collapsed. And the reason is because these buildings, first of all, are fireproofed, but even then, the fireproofing only lasts 2 or 3 hours. So when these we're talking fires that are 18 hours over 5 floors, Caracas, Venezuela is a great example. There are many others, which I'll highlight for you. But they have not collapsed because the properties of steel are such that it is very, very extremely dense material. It wicks away heat from the source. And it spreads it out throughout the steel structure of the building. Los Angeles burned 3.5 hours over 5 floors. Philadelphia, 1991, 18 hours over 8 floors. And in New York, this high-rise burned for 6 hours. In Caracas, Venezuela, 17 hours over 26 floors. And yet we're expected to believe that on 9/11 we have a small fire, by all stretch of the imagination, in the South Tower, that burned for only 56 minutes, and yet, and was supposed to have been brought this building down, but you say, oh, wait, it was kerosene, a jet fuel. Well, jet fuel is just another hydrocarbon. It doesn't burn any hotter than the office furniture in the building, and 90% of it was burnt outside the building, and 10 minutes later, the rest of it was burnt inside the building.
Okay, Richard, let me get to Ron's response to that. The kerosene doesn't burn hot enough. It wouldn't have got the job done.
Conceptually, a Volkswagen Beetle and a Formula One car are the same, but we know that they're designed differently. We know that one car will take more impact. It's designed to do that. When you compare buildings that have had a fire in them for a long period of time, you're looking at an old-fashioned building that was built out of steel and thick cement. The World Trade Center buildings were a completely different concept. They used very lightweight concrete pads. They used a truss system, which had never been used extensively before. And to compare the two of them, I think, is really false. I think what we have to say is, if anything, that perhaps the buildings that are built with truss and small concrete pads probably aren't as safe, and from history we now can see are not as safe as the buildings made from girders and 8 inches or more of cement.
Ron, though, explain what seems to be just beyond all rational explanation to me anyway, the near symmetrical collapse, particularly of Building 7. How do you explain
that? Well, hold on. That's another subject, Richard. Let me respond to Ron's point here, because it's a whole other subject. He mentioned that the floor trusses were, this particular system was not used before. In fact, that is true, and they won a large annual award from the American Society of Civil Engineers for this innovation. And in fact, this is the innovation called the tube within a tube that Ron is referring to. It is now used on virtually all high-rise skyscrapers, particularly because it is so efficient as well as safe. So if it weren't safe, we would be dismantling skyscrapers throughout the world today, because they have the same system. They do not have 8-inch thick concrete. Most of them have 4 or 5-inch thick concrete. And in fact, the Twin Towers were built with a the structure within a structure, as you alluded to, the core structure was built with an immense set of 47 steel box columns that were almost solid steel at the base, rising and thinning with height. And they were 52 inches by 22 inches at the base and in the corners, and in between those, 16 by 30 inches. So, and this was this structure was held together by a separate system of girders and 5-inch thick concrete. So we're talking 30-inch deep girders under this core. And so any scenario which would have caused floor trusses to collapse, which is dubious, but we'll get into that later, would have left this core structure standing 1,000 feet in the air, virtually indestructible. There's no possible explanation for its destruction, even with this pile driver, which we're told pushed this building down at virtually free fall speed.
All right, Richard, let me cut in here. We'll take a time out, come back, and Ron, you can respond to some of the points that Richard has made. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineer for 9/11 Truth, and Ron Craig is a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers. Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Welcome to a special two-hour debate, the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center's Towers 1 and 2 and Building 7, being debated here. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Ron Craig, who is our demolitions expert. He is a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers and the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. And first, I have to commend both of you. It's actually kind of refreshing to have two individuals debate something rationally, just interested in getting the information out without it sort of degenerating into name-calling and personal attacks, which is really sort of the characterizes most of the debates when we get into this this issue. So I commend you both for your civility. And I want to ask Ron about Ron Craig, one of the initial points that Richard made, and that was the chemical evidence for an incendiary device known as thermite, which seems to be present at the World Trade Center towers in the aftermath. Several witnesses talking about it. I believe it's been captured on video. How do you respond to that, Ron, that this incendiary device would be there?
First of all, no explosives expert would use thermite to cut any beams. You would use shaped linear charges using high explosive. There's absolutely no reason to use a thermite charge.
I could give you a reason.
Okay, go ahead, Richard, please.
If you wanted the building to come down and blame it on fire, which is not explosive in nature, you would use a different type of charge. You would use an incendiary to cut the beams. You would not use explosives, which would give away your project. Thermite is a high-tech incendiary used by the military to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And when with sulfur added, it lowers the temperature of the melting point of steel. And so what we find, therefore, by FEMA in the ends of these beams is sulfidation, intergranular melting. Remember, fire, normal office fires do not melt steel, and you also find FEMA found rapid oxidation. The New York Times described this the biggest mystery of all in 9/11.
Okay, interesting. Ron, continue.
First of all, thermite is a very low-tech material. It's made up of an iron oxide, an aluminum, and there's also going to be an oxidizer like barium nitrate. I've used the material, Richard. I would imagine that you haven't, but it's not as exciting as you make it sound. When you put it on a piece of steel, it burns through the steel, the slag falls onto the ground, and it starts to solidify. And that's the extent of what happens when you use a thermite charge. In terms of actually efficiency, I can take a small piece of plastic explosive, make a linear charge from it, and cut through a beam as surgically as a knife through a piece of bread. I definitely wouldn't use thermite. A building like the World Trade Center is a chemical cocktail. There's everything in that building from pesticides, gases, materials in the cushions. Virtually anything that you can imagine is there. So in the debris from selected samples, you're going to find just about anything.
Did you want to respond to that, Richard?
What you wouldn't find if thermite wasn't used In other words, what Dr. Jones, a physicist from formerly from Brigham Young University, found is the exact chemical signature of thermite in an EDS analysis in several different samples sent to him by several different people. And you can read all about this in his paper, Applying the Scientific Method to the World Trade Center. And that is on our website at ae911truth.org. Where 200 architects and engineers have banded together demanding a new investigation of Congress with subpoena power because of all of this evidence that's assembled on this website. What Dr. Jones found was in the end, in the slag from the ends of these beams, as well as in previously molten metal chunks. Molten metal, where did that come from? Again, fire can't melt steel. So the firemen found tons of molten metal flowing like lava, they say. The World Trade Center structural engineer, Leslie Robertson, says it's flowing after 21 days, still flowing, molten metal. And nobody knew where all this was coming from. But it's explained because molten iron is the byproduct, as you mentioned, Ron, of a aluminothermic reaction. So he finds the exact chemical signature in the EDS spectrum analysis. That may not be the right term, but he finds sulfur in it. He finds iron oxide. He finds aluminum, all the chemicals you just mentioned.
Okay, let me ask Ron then directly. How then do you explain this river of molten lava, molten metal that was reported by people on the scene in videos? I've seen the videos.
If you've ever been to a car explosion in a fire, of which I've been to hundreds of them, if you look underneath the car, you'll see material that's melting out from under it that looks like steel. And in fact, most people, when they look at it, will say, it's melting the steel. And it's not melting the steel. What you're seeing is you're seeing pot metal, which is used in some of the car parts, specifically the ignition, that's actually melts at a very low temperature, and it melts out and it hits the ground and it pools. You're looking at solder. You're looking at solder from wires. Everything is explainable if you look at it. I want to assure the audience that thermite isn't some high-tech charge. It's rust, aluminum, and an oxidizer. Very easy to manufacture, and in fact, in all of the improvised explosives manuals, it's clearly explained how to make it. So we're not talking about a high-tech material here. Everything is explainable. Richard, what's not explainable is how something could run for 21 days. The only thing that can run for 21 days without solidifying is water if it doesn't freeze.
Well, there must have been some ongoing chemical reactions in the molten metal, because not only the World Trade Center structural engineer, a viable witness, but plenty of first responders, firemen, describing it. And in fact, these fires, they could not put out after 6 or 8 weeks. NASA had aerial photos after many, many weeks showing these hot spots on the surface of 1,340 degrees. That's hotter than the fires themselves. And what we're talking about is what's creating those temperatures is six stories down in the basement substructure. That's where the hottest temperatures were, and that's where they saw all of this molten metal flowing. Now, Dr. Jones found that it is not aluminum from the airplane in his chemical analysis. He found that it's not structural steel because it doesn't contain chromium. And he finds the exact same chemical signature of thermite, of the aluminothermic reaction, with the iron oxide, the iron, the sulfur, and manganese and fluorine, fluorine being the oxidizer used in aluminothermic reactions.
All right, listen, we've got to take a time out. I'll get you a moment to respond when we come back as we continue to discuss the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center, a special two-hour debate here on The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. Welcome to our two-hour debate concerning the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. An architect, of course, California-based designer of fireproof steel-framed buildings, and Ron Craig, a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers and the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. Ron does not believe they were brought down by controlled demolition. Richard, of course, does. Ron, I'll let you make one final point on the thermite, then we've got to move on. We could probably talk about 2 hours on thermite alone, and then I have a question about Richard regarding the placement of said demolition devices. Okay, Ron.
Whenever a building is on fire and it collapses, there are going to be hot spots underneath it for a considerable period of time. When firefighters are doing reclamation, when they're actually going through looking for those hot spots to put them out, when you move some debris and there's enough oxygen present, it flares up into a fire. They can sputter away for a considerable period of time. What we have is the largest building that's ever collapsed in history, and it was on fire, and there was a considerable amount of fire in it, contrary to what Richard says, and it would be totally logical that as it collapsed that there would be hot spots that could be picked up by satellites. It would be totally believable.
Richard, a quick response, and then I'll ask you a question.
Yeah, the other thing, the other evidence for thermite is twofold. One, we have yellow, hot, molten metal flowing out of the South Tower, which is bright, glowing yellow and orange, and materials that are have lower melting points, like Ron was describing, do not glow bright orange in daylight, certainly, and certainly in aluminum does not either. It's silvery. Secondly, there's microspheres of iron-rich material found in the World Trade Center dust. Three or four different samples sent to Dr. Jones. He's, in all of them, he's found these almost naked to the human eye and as large as a BB. Perfectly round formed, previously molten iron spheres. Where did they come from? Well, if thousands of charges were set at the beams and columns throughout the building, and then you have these explosions that would disperse this molten liquid, the surface tension would form itself into perfectly round spheres, and you would have this sprayed then all over Lower Manhattan and mixed with the dust, and could be also responsible for why there are so many people dying as a result of inhaling this dust. But that's a rat's nest. Dr. Jones found thermite, the same chemicals in these spheres as he did in the molten slag.
Richard, let me ask you about these devices that may have been placed inside the building. Many people, the question they ask is, how, given the enormous amount, I'm guessing, of devices you'd have to place in there, and the time required to wire a building like that, to rig a building like that, how did they get them into the building?
Well, I think that's a superb and obvious question, and one has to look at some of the relevant evidence, such as the fact that we did, in fact, have an elevator modernization going on the 9 months prior to 9/11, and the by ACE elevator, and the core columns appear next to all of the elevators in the core. So it would have been quite easy for a team to access through the elevator hoistway in the guise of this modernization, take out the gypsum board fire protection of the hoistway and the columns, and plant these charges. Now, how would they have gotten through security? The security obviously would have had to have been in on this. And in fact, we know that the security company was changed 6 weeks prior to 9/11. In fact, Marvin Bush and Wirt Walker III, another Bush family member, were on the board of that security company that took over. So that's just an interesting anecdote. But these are the reasons that 200 architects and engineers are demanding a new investigation to get at the bottom of these. I try to stick with some of the technical facts. So I think that'll help.
All right. When we come back, we have to break yet again. Ron, as someone who's familiar with the demolitions field, I'll get your take on whether it would be plausible to place charges in there. How many might it take, and where might they be placed? That sort of thing. Ron Craig in studio, member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers, and International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. Richard Gage, architect and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. And I see the phone line starting to fill up. Thanks for your patience. We will get to the phone calls after the top of the hour as we continue to discuss, debate, controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center, Towers 1 and 2, Building 7. Richard Gage, an architect, California-based designer of steel-framed fireproof buildings, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth on the line, and Ron Craig, our bomb and demolition expert in studio. And Richard, off the top of the program, outlined quite tightly the motive for the demolition of the World Trade Center towers, provide a pretext for invasion of Iraq, Afghanistan, the creation of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act. Now let's talk a little bit about opportunity. Richard, you addressed that as well, how they may have been able to get the explosive devices into the building. Let me run that one by our demolitions expert, Ron Craig.
Well, to begin with, some of the columns were not accessible, and that comes out clearly in the inspection reports that were done, where they regularly inspected the beams. Also, let me point out that if a person inside the building felt a vibration or heard a noise, they would immediately tell building maintenance, and an inspection would take place in case there was a critical beam that was failing, it was some kind of problem that would compromise the structural integrity of the building. So let's return to the elevator shafts. It used a very novel system of construction, which was very thick, 2-inch thick gypsum. That was designed to be a fire barrier, as well as, I suppose, and Richard would know better than I, some kind of a linear support for the elevator area itself. What we're talking about here is an almost impossibility to put explosive-shaped charges or any type of charges, even thermite charges, which I don't believe were used, on some of the key beams, which means that you wouldn't have a perfect implosion.
Richard, do you want to respond?
Well, sure. You suggested, Ron, first of all, that thermite charges you don't believe were used, but I just cited plenty of chemical evidence with chain of custody, Providence records that you can look at, and all the listeners can look at on our website, ae911truth.org.
We'll invite them to do that because I don't want to go back to the thermite argument. I know it's important, but we could probably do 2 hours. But let's talk about what Ron is now saying about access to certain core.
Well, he's
columns.
Saying it's impossible to put the charges on the beams and columns, but he didn't say why. They're clearly accessible to most all of them from the elevator shafts, the core columns. Now, we believe that they did not have access to the exterior columns, and that's why the explosives had to be so intense. This is not a typical controlled demolition by any means. So intense, such as to hurl these beams 55 miles an hour laterally, landing 500 feet away. And that only such intensity would then take out the perimeter columns, which were up to 60 feet away.
Let me ask just a few, about 30 seconds here, Ron. The lateral trajectory of much of the debris, what do you make of that? Is that consistent with your theory of how they were brought down?
Absolutely no one on earth has ever seen a building of that size collapse. So to try and determine what would happen and say it was unnatural for those beams to land where they are, I think is pure speculation.
All right. Let's look at the 700 bone fragments that were less than a half an inch in length found on the top of the Deutsche Bank building all the way across the street. If there was a gravitational collapse, as the official story tells us, the floors would have entrapped those people, not blown their body parts out all the way across, in fact, the boundary of the World Trade Center. In fact, there's 20,000 pieces of bodies found, and there's only 2,700 bodies to account for. One person was blown to over 200 pieces alone.
All right, we've got to take a time out for news with John Elston next here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. On the other side, more of our debate with Ron Craig, our demolitions expert, and Richard Gage, architect, engineer for 9/11 Truth. You're listening to The Richard Serrett Show here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Welcome back. Just a programming note that Nils Hammerin, our end times expert from Somerville, New Jersey, not with us tonight to make way for the two-hour debate. He rejoins us next Monday. Nils Hammerin, counting down to Armageddon. Right now we continue along with our special two-hour debate, the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center, Towers 1, 2, and Building 7. Richard Gage, a founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Ron Craig, member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers, International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators. Richard, Ron, how are we both doing? You're not too tired?
Great.
All right. I feel good, and I'm ready to go.
All right, the two combatants are ready. Now, I want to pick up on a point you made, Richard, before the break, and that was not only the lateral trajectory of the debris, but also the discovery of bone fragments. How far away did you say they were, Richard?
They're across the street on top of the Deutsche Bank building. 700 of them found there, and God knows how many of them found or not found elsewhere.
All right, and Ron, I know you want to respond to that.
Well, I'm not surprised. We had a Boeing 762-200ER weighing 395,000 pounds with a fuel load of 90,000 liters of fuel, flying at 590 miles an hour, coming to a stop almost instantly as it hit the building. Anybody inside that plane would have been fragmented into small pieces. I certainly don't want to gross your audience out, but if you go to a plane crash that takes place in a field or on land, you're going to find larger body parts. But when you actually have a plane that hits a hard surface, even the water, it's very seldom that you find large parts. They're all scattered into small ones. So it's totally conceivable they'd be spread over a very large area.
I believe that the Deutsche Bank building was on the side of the building that the airplane was coming in on. So that argument, if that's true, and I think it is, wouldn't hold water.
If the fuel itself ignited as I expected that it did and as reports have indicated, it would be a fuel-air explosion, which is one of the most powerful explosions. Now, I agree that it wasn't a total explosion. Not all of the potential of that 90,000 liters went off, because we know that some of the fuel actually went down columns and so on and went on to other floors. But that would certainly contribute to the explosion, Richard. There's no question about it.
All right. But
there was also, in addition, as regarding explosions, there's 118 firefighters who were recorded. There's 1,000 who were recorded, and the New York Times sued the city to release these recordings, and finally the State Court of Appeals last year, or 2005, released this, and 118 of these oral recordings were first responders talking about, specifically about explosions. We heard the pops around the building. I thought the terrorists planted explosives in the buildings. You know, it was wrapping all the way around the building like a belt, all these explosions. And it's extraordinary how reading 118 independent professional descriptions of explosions at the onset of collapse. And then, they say, the debris came out of the building, some kind of crushing.
Richard, you've anticipated my next question. So, Ron, Craig, how do you respond to these the sounds of explosions heard by these witnesses?
What I'd like to do is I'd like to refer to one of the main forensic engineering textbooks that's been written called Forensic Engineering. And there's one section in it that actually deals with eyewitness accounts. And the gentleman that's actually doing this is not only a professional engineer, licensed professional engineer, but he's also a certified forensic person as well, who can testify in court as an expert witness. And he says, "My experience with eyewitness accounts of failures is that they are often not accurate or reliable. This is not because eyewitnesses are dishonest, but because most do not have the necessary technical training, and when involved in catastrophes, they frequently are distracted by other issues and come away with a distorted view of the events." Quite interestingly, a beam was constructed that was very similar to the truss system. In fact, it was identical to the truss system used in the World Trade Center building, and it was tested here in Toronto. At the Canadian Standards Association lab, we have one of the largest furnaces available. This huge beam was put in. It was heated up to temperature. One of the things that was totally unexpected was a loud bang, a loud report, which in the report they reference. And not only did they hear the large report, but when they actually looked at the slabs of cement on the top, there was significant spalling. And also there was a huge crack across the cement. And that's what I would tell you happens to eyewitnesses. They hear things, they anticipate that it's explosives, but in fact it's not. And just to make one further point, yeah. I went to a fire where there was a fire inside a garage at a townhouse. All of the people were outside. The medical emergency people were there as well. The car was burning inside the garage door was closed, and all of a sudden bang started to take place, and immediately the EMS worker turned towards me and said, "The gas tank has gone, and now other cans of gas are going." It turned out to be the tires on the car, which I knew because I'd heard tires explode before when they caught on fire. So it goes to show how witnesses can be misled.
Richard, one final response, and then we'll go to the calls.
Sorry, the photographs and the videos match perfectly with these 118 stories of witnesses, professionals, again, not just normal people, but firemen who are prone to know whether something is an explosion or a piece of concrete cracking. You look at all the videos on the photographs, they show lateral ejection, which is consistent with the explosions.
Richard, I actually... lecture to fire department people about explosives and they understand very little about it. And one of the reasons that I lecture to them is to give them information about what they're dealing with if they do come across explosives. So I would tell you they're not the most dependable witness and they're not trying to mislead anyone. It's just that they haven't seen the phenomenon before.
All right. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Ron Craig, member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers. Let's go to the calls as we continue our debate on the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center, the Richard Serrett Show here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. And we're going to go to Phoenix and say hello to Craig. Welcome to News Talk 1010 CFRB, Craig.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Interesting discussion tonight. It feels like your explosives expert was trying to come across as more of an architect than an engineer in the building, where I'm not really hearing him defend, you know, how a building falls at free fall speed. I'd like, I guess, to perhaps ask a theoretical question. Let's say we're going to build an amusement park in downtown New York City, and we need to blow up the Trade Center to quickly, you know, get the project underway and move it away. And you know, how an explosives engineer would make that happen. And then the second question would be, how does he explain World Trade Center Building Number 7?
All right, lots of questions there. Let's begin with the idea that the buildings collapsed at free fall speed.
First of all, I'm not an engineer and I'm not an architect. What I am is an explosives expert. So I'm going to leave that for people to speculate on. I know looking at the websites, there are many different theories about the collapse of it, whether it was brought down by gravity faster than it should have been brought down and so on and so forth. And that's not where I really want to go. Where I want to go is, how could you put in the number of explosive charges on all the columns and perfectly time it when it's totally impossible to do that, particularly with the wreckage of the plane that had actually taken out some of the floors?
Well, that's speculation for me, and I did speculate a little bit for you on that, but I will address Richard's question directly. What we have is, what we're told is that there's a 20-story pile driver in the official story driving down because the building underneath could not possibly handle the weight. Well, the problem is that we have, it's going straight down through the path of most resistance, that is to say 80,000 tons of intact cold structural steel designed to resist exactly that load, having done that for the last 30 years and the lifespan of this building for the next 50. Free fall speed, virtually. You drop a billiard ball, you get about 9.2 seconds drop. These buildings, according to the official story, took 10 seconds. The only way that can happen, and the only way that can happen symmetrically and uniformly, is if you remove the columns all the way around the building, that is to say, in the case of the Twin Towers, the core columns, within a fraction of a second. Otherwise, you have an asymmetrical collapse. And those who are experienced with controlled demolitions and setting them up know that there are far more failures than successes. In other words, buildings do tend to fall over because it is an exact science, and one or two explosions going off at the wrong time can really affect a building. So this it caused an asymmetrical collapse. So this was a very, very, very professional job.
Okay, we need to take a time out, Ron. I'll give you a chance to respond to that. Also, we need to speak about Building 7 and how one could explain its apparent symmetrical collapse into its own footprint when it wasn't struck by a plane. Ron Craig is with the International Society of Explosives Engineers, and Richard Gage, architect, founder of Architects and Engineer for 9/11 Truth. Back with more of the Richard Serrett Show and your calls here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Right. We are about a half an hour away from the end of our two-hour debates, and we're going to try to work in as many calls as we can. I appreciate people's patience. We're discussing or debating the controlled demolition hypothesis for the collapse of the World Trade Center. I'm just looking at some of the calls here, and BJ in Austin, for example, wants to know about black ops financing. I think that's probably not within the context of this debate, so I don't know if we can help you on that one. That's something perhaps one or the other would like to speculate about. So BJ in Austin, unless you can think of something a little more germane to our discussion, we'll have to let you go. Now, I want to get to a call here. But before I do, we're going to go to Brian in Kingston. Ron, I wanted you to have a chance to respond to Richard's point, and somebody help me out here now. Richard, the point you were making just before the break...
it was a perfect controlled demolition. It was done by experts.
Yes, and the symmetry in which the buildings dropped, et cetera. Get your response to that.
The free fall speed.
The free fall speed, thank you.
Well, let's get to the nut of the matter, which is there are a lot of beams, and it would require a lot of explosives and a lot of wire. My calculations show there would have to be a trunk of wire 3 miles long that would be hooked up to a firing system. That's number one.
Unless you used wireless.
And I'll get to that in a minute. Number two, you would have to have all of those charges perfectly synchronized to go off at a certain time. And I'm telling you, Richard, it's not going to be possible to do it because no one could anticipate the damage to the building. And if you look at the way the building collapsed, it collapses from the top down. Also, we're looking at a very large quantity of explosives here. Do you have any idea, Richard, how much explosives would be required to actually drop the building?
I'm told that that a team of 24 men could do it in a few months, and that it would be something like 1,300 pounds. But I am not the explosives expert. Have you ever brought down a building with controlled demolition?
Actually, I've brought down 5 buildings, and I was part of a demolition of a building that was an implosion as well. I wasn't responsible for it. One of the things that Richard hasn't alluded to is the fact that I'm an experienced special effects supervisor, and pyrotechnics and explosives are my specialty, so I've blown up just about everything on Earth that you can imagine, trucks and cars. But I want to return back to the actual building. We're talking about a feat here that would be almost impossible, if not totally impossible, to do, and have it work that way without people in the building knowing. And I want to point out, Richard, that there were a number of inspections that were that took place in that building on a regular basis. Plus, when anyone heard a vibration or felt a vibration and they heard a noise, it would spark an inspection. And those inspections involved drilling into beams, using a scope to see if there was any rust inside the beams. So I'm telling you, it would be physically impossible to hide 1,300 pounds of explosive if that's what you think it would take to take it down.
Not if you were in charge of the security of the building, and we've addressed that issue already.
Nobody would actually see the explosive charges. You wouldn't see a shaped linear charge on a beam
access,
and say, gee, I wonder what that is?
We're talking about access from the elevator hoistway, which no occupant of the building has access to. I don't know if you heard me. And you're not talking about miles of wire, because wireless control, as you know, as an explosives expert, is very common these days.
It's very common, but there's absolutely no controller that would take that number of charges and do it. Plus, I also will point out that buildings don't receive signals very well, having done a lot of work using actually send and receive units. So I would think that you would have a fair number of failures. Also, if I go to your website, I actually see where you point out that there is puffs of dust, which you think are squibs. You call them squibs. And at one point in your presentation, you point out this flame that's taking place, and you point out that those are actually explosive charges taking place. And I'm telling you, when an explosive changes from a solid to a gas almost instantly, creating heat and pressure equally in all directions, it creates a flash. But it's a very violent flash, and the flashes that I saw that you pointed out in your lecture actually were carbon fuel. And they were lazy, they were broiling, and they had black smoke coming from them, all of which indicates that it was a carbon fuel phenomenon.
Let's discuss, first of all, the squibs that you mentioned, because they're extremely important. 20, 40, and even 60 stories below the ensuing collapse, you have explosions coming out of the building, and people can see it very, very easily on our DVD, which is accessible in the website. And we're told by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked with explaining all of this, is that this pile driver at the top of the building is pushing the air down through these elevator shafts, and thus it's coming out into the space, and of course it has to go somewhere. Well, first of all, there's a few problems with this theory. First of all, there's no pile driver. After about 4 seconds, the entire 20 or 30 story section has disintegrated. To watch it in any of the videos, and then from there you have the building tearing itself apart at free fall speed. Second, these are not puffs of air, they're pulverized buildings materials. Third, they're on video, so you can calculate their speed. We're talking 160 to 200 feet per second, and as you know, Ron, these are explosive speeds, not air ejection speeds.
So what is a squib then, Richard?
Well, I presume it would be a mistimed explosion, and in this case, they occur exactly at the midpoint between the corners of the buildings, mostly the midpoints, and they're highly focalized such that there's only one or two windows being blown out in each one of them. So I can't explain them. I'm not the explosives expert,
okay,
but they are there, and the video evidence is there. I mean, have you seen them?
Well, we'll ask Ron that question when we come back. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Ron Craig, our demolitions expert. We'll get to some calls as well when we come back here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right, control demolition, yes or no? We're talking about the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, towers at 1 and 2, building number 7, a special two-hour debate. Richard Gage, arguing in favor, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11. Arguing against is Ron Craig, a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers. And we're going to work now another leading researcher into 9/11, and that would be Jim Hoffman, who is a software engineer by profession, but has been intensively researching the attack of 9/11, educating others about his findings for the past 3 years. He created WTC7.net and 911review.com and a number of other websites. Jim, welcome to News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Thank you.
I'm sure you have a specific question for Ron Craig.
Well, I actually had a few comments. I thought that he brought up a number of red herrings, saying that thermite isn't high tech. When, you know, if it gets the job done, what kind of point is that? There's also forms of thermite that are more reactive, like nanothermite, thermite, accelerated forms. He says it doesn't look, or the aspects of it don't look. They look more like a deflagration. They don't look like high tech explosives going off. Well, you know, there's any of a number of possibilities of what kinds of explosives were used. We don't know exactly how it was engineered. We can only speculate. We can't possibly know how it might have been engineered. So to apply analysis based on how buildings are typically engineered for demolition and saying that because that would have been difficult, it couldn't possibly have been done is simply a logical error. To talk about they would have needed thousands of feet of deck cord or that you couldn't synchronize a wireless system to do it, I can't see why you couldn't. If there was a problem with transmission, you could use redundant repeaters inside the building to make sure that the signals got to the charges in the proper timing and so forth. I mean, there's ways these problems could have been solved. But what I would like to emphasize more than anything is what the physical realities of these events were. I'd urge your listeners to go to the web and actually look at the videos and photographs of the Twin Towers exploding at a Building 7 going straight down into its footprint in the manner of a perfectly engineered controlled demolition. Because we can talk about all these speculations about how it was done, but the fact is that to say that these were spontaneous natural collapses just doesn't fit with the fact that these events were so well engineered to come so down in such a precise vertical manner. Natural processes tend to evolve to states of less symmetry, not states of more symmetry. And for the South Tower to start to lean, but then instead of toppling over, as it appeared to be doing when it was leaning to about 15 degrees to the east, and then just suddenly explode from the bottom up, and then just being consumed by this giant explosion, that speaks of a engineered event, not a natural collapse event. So, yes, it's true that we haven't seen a building of such size undergo a natural collapse event, but what we have seen is large buildings being destroyed by controlled demolition. And here we see all these physical characteristics that match controlled demolitions hand in glove. So to say that it's just a natural collapse when there's no evidence pointing to that it is such, and yet all the evidence points in the direction of it being a controlled demolition, is an overwhelming argument that it's controlled demolition.
Jim Hoffman, thank you for that, and made a lot of points. Ron, if you want to pick up on any of those, and then we do need to get into Building 7 and talk about that a little bit.
I don't even know where to start, because what we basically had was a plate of spaghetti there in terms of a large number of arguments, so I really don't know where to pick it up. But let me go back to the explosives. We know what explosives would have to be used to implode the building. You would need explosives that would actually become cutting charges, which means C4 plastic explosives or something similar to it.
Or thermite.
Thermite is, I think, an issue that is a red herring, to use the expression that Mr. Hoffman just used, because I don't see why anybody would use it. It's rather like using a lawnmower engine instead of a souped-up go-kart engine if I want to drive something at a high speed. I would actually use a shaped linear charge made out of plastic explosive that I know would work predictably, and it would work exceptionally well. It would cut through the steel. I can calculate it. I know exactly what quantity is required to cause the result that I'm after. Thermite is a guess and a roll of the dice, and who knows how it's going to work. So anybody that would calculate that into their plans, I think, would be really foolish, and I think they would risk failure.
Okay.
They did a pretty good job, actually. All you have to do is over-engineer it, which obviously is what happened with all this incredible explosiveness and tons of molten metal. They overdid it. That explains that. Let's get to Building 7.
Yeah, the symmetrical collapse. I mean, it's quite, when you look at it, I mean, just any observer looking at the video who's seen, the Sands Hotel being brought down in Las Vegas, it's a favorite filler on CNN, collapse, controlled demolition.
There's 10 characteristics of controlled demolition, and let me just name them for your viewers, and they can even watch online as we're talking by going to ae911truth.org. And in upper right corner, you can see the flash video going down, along with the 200 architects and engineers who are demanding this real investigation. What the 10 characteristics are is we have a sudden, rapid onset of destruction at the base of the building, even though fires, by the way, were on upper floors. Sights and sounds produced by explosions, that is to say, ear witnesses and eyewitnesses of flashes and explosions at the base, and then the building came down, they say. Incredible dust clouds, thick, billowing, and enormous from the pulverized concrete. We're talking pyroclastic dust clouds. Ron will know this very well, where the smoke enfolds itself because of all of the incredible heat. We have chemical evidence of cutter charges and pools of molten iron underneath Building 7. That's a characteristic. Excuse me. That's not typical of controlled demolitions, as Ron has pointed out. We have squibs also, or these mistimed explosions occurring at the upper seven stories on the right side of the building. As you're looking at the flash video on our website, you see puff, 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 puff. These black smoke explosions up there, they can only be squibs or explosions. They went off at the wrong time. They're supposed to go off when that part of the building got all the way down. So we have demolition waves removing the column support within a fraction of an inch of each other, fraction of a second of each other, starting with the interior columns and then progressing outward a tenth of a second later to the perimeter columns, and then floor by floor, synchronistically timed, so that the building the weight of the building's harnessed to do much of the destruction. This results in a total collapse of the steel, where the steel skeleton is completely broken up for shipment, not a mangled heap of a grid of structural elements. All of this results in a straight-down, symmetrical collapse of the building into its own footprint. In the case of Building 7, we're talking about an implosion at free fall speed.
Okay, when we come back, Ron, I want you to counter Richard's argument, maybe go down some of his 10 points on the features of a controlled demolition, and we'll focus on the collapse of Building 7, part of the World Trade Center complex, when we come back. Our two-hour debate just about three-quarters of the way home here on the Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. All right. Obviously, we need at least 3 hours to discuss this. We only have two, and while time permits, we're discussing the collapse of Building 7 as we're debating the controlled demolition hypothesis. Ron Craig, I want you to respond to some of the points that Richard Craig made, Jim Hoffman as well. Let's talk about the symmetrical collapse of Building 7. I mean, what do you make of that? How can you explain that away?
Well, let's just go back just briefly, if I may, to one of the points Richard made about the squibs, because this is a big deal that I see on all of the sites where they talk about the mistimed squibs going off. They will conveniently point out that an explosion has gone off here and there's a big flash from it, but of course this is a squib and all that's happened is there's a bit of dust coming out, but it indicates that it's a controlled explosion. And again, I want to go back as a fire and an explosion investigator, and I want to say, how were the explosives brought into Building 7, put onto beams, if they use shaped linear charges, which I would do instead of ribbon charges, how did they set them up so that absolutely nobody that went into that building saw anything suspicious? It's almost impossible. Now, when we're talking about the building, the one thing about Building 7 is it was practically ignored during the trauma of the two planes hitting the building, the people escaping from the building, first responders going in to try to save people. And, in fact, it was obscured by smoke for a lot of that period of time. We do not know what kind of damage took place or the amount of vibration that that building took. We have absolutely no idea. But having said that, unless somebody can prove to me that the explosives were smuggled in, put onto beams, directly coordinated so that there was a perfect implosion, then I have to eliminate scientifically that an implosion could have occurred.
Oh, that's very interesting. We are demanding a new investigation to find out exactly why and how and who was responsible regarding the placement of these explosives. But the evidence itself, you say, isn't valid unless that's found out, but that's not true. That's not a logical argument. The evidence is clear in and of itself simply due to the 10 characteristics of typical controlled demolitions that I just cited to you, but which fire cannot explain even one of these characteristics, let alone all 10.
Explain how it could fall into its own footprint symmetrically if it was simply a case of fire.
Let's take a look at that, because that's a very interesting point. Right from the very beginning, as the architects and the engineers were designing the building and the fire department was looking at the design of the building, there were significant concerns about those trusses and their ability to take heat. What generally isn't known by the public is the substance that was actually used to fireproof them, the SFRM, had never been tested. In fact, there's absolutely no records whatsoever that anyone ever tested that material before they put it onto the beams. Richard, we know that when a beam receives 500 degrees or more of heat, it tends to become more elastic. That's a fact. It doesn't melt. And in fact, if you take a look, and I'm going to return for a moment to the World Trade Center building that collapsed and it looked like it was leaning over a bit on the top. That's a fact that was actually established by a police officer in a helicopter who said, I see the side of the building caving in, and I can see that the top is starting to bend over, and I think there's going to be a collapse. And in fact, it did happen. Let me point out to you that a radical organization like the University of Honolulu actually modeled that building collapse, and they did so in their computer, in their labs, and they found that it behaved exactly as we saw it collapsing. Let's return now to building number 7. Building number 7 collapsed because of a series of engineering failures that we should be looking at. I think that's very important. So both Richard and I agree we should be doing some investigation. But claiming that explosives brought it down, I think, is a red herring.
All right.
Let's look at this, though. We have foreknowledge of the collapse in several witnesses. In fact, some mysterious construction workers and policemen caught on tape by CNN. They say, keep your eye on that building. It's about to come down. That building is about to blow up, the policeman says. Now, never before in history, of course, has a steel frame fire-protected building, as I documented, ever come down high-rise due to fire. But all of a sudden, they're announcing the imminent collapse of this building. Not only that, the BBC announces the collapse 20 minutes before it actually happened. They actually must have had a script. They said the 47-story Solomon Brothers building close to the World Trade Center has also collapsed. And there it is, right behind her on video, standing proudly. And of course, they apologize for this mistake, citing the confusion of the day. But does that make them psychic?
Well, if we take a look at it, at the objective evidence, we're talking about a reporter who has no scientific skills, I would assume, more than being able to report the news and do it well. We also saw where at least one newscaster, a very experienced one, broke down and started to cry on air. We're talking about a very emotional moment here. I go back to the fact that witnesses often don't make good statements, or they don't make accurate statements about what's occurring because it's outside of their technical expertise and they've never seen it before. So taking a few statements that people make and concluding that therefore they were in on it, I think is quite a specious
argument. What about
argument.
Larry Silverstein, who is quoted as saying, let's pull it?
Well, that would assume that, in fact, it was all wired and ready to go, or we had this magical remote controller that's going to set it off, and it's going to take a command from the owner. I mean, it absolutely makes no sense. And anybody that believes that, I think, is really steering us away from why the building collapsed, which I'll get into at the end of the broadcast, perhaps, but I think that it collapsed because of a series of factors that had never happened to a building of that size ever before.
All right. Can I take a call? Do we need to break away here? We need to break. All right, we'll come back and hopefully have time for one or two quick calls and maybe some summations from both of our guests. Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, arguing that the World Trade Center Towers 1, 2, and 7 brought down by controlled demolition. And Ron Craig, member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers, saying they were not brought down by controlled demolition. The Richard Serrett Show, News Talk 1010 CFRB. Ron Craig, as we debate the World Trade Center Towers and controlled demolition.
Hi there.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
It's actually Ryan.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ryan.
My question is for Ron. Well, Richard's pretty much answered all of my questions. So for Ron, I am wondering how you explain the sub-basement explosions prior to the first plane hitting to the tower?
Sub-basement explosions prior to the plane hitting the tower.
Well, actually, I have absolutely no explanation for them because of the fact that... as far as I'm concerned, they didn't take place. There were loud noises. There were problems down there, but it sure wasn't caused by explosive.
Richard, do you want to respond briefly to that as well?
Sure. There's a number of witnesses that back up Willie Rodriguez's claim, the hero that was brought into the White House by President Bush, and wanted him to run for office until he started talking or continuing to talk about all of the explosions that he heard that ripped the skin off of Felipe David down there, and he comes up saying, explosion, explosion. And then about 7 seconds later, he hears this bah, as he describes it, of the airplane hitting way up top. So he says, this explosion caused his feet and the floor to jump up and pushed him up. And did incredible damage down there. A 50-ton hydraulic press was completely destroyed.
Okay, let me grab another.
Plenty of examples.
Another quick call before we get to your final points. And John, you're next on News Talk 1010 CFRB.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
I think the controlled demolition hypothesis of the towers and World Trade Center 7 can be largely disproven with one simple observation, and that is that demolition charges are deafeningly loud. If a demolition charge went off anywhere on 9/11, everyone within a mile radius, every camera, every video would have recorded it.
Well, that's why they would have used thermite, which is a more silent special form of thermite with added sulfur, because you wouldn't want a whole bunch of explosions to be heard, even though they were. It's not a perfect science. We have 118 witnesses just from those who were recorded
in
oral histories.
I've got 4 minutes, so I'm going to offer Ron you 2 minutes summation and you, Richard, 2 minutes to make your final points. Go ahead, Ron Craig.
Okay, the point that I want to make is that in 1993, 1,300 pounds of explosives went off in the parking lot of the World Trade Center building. It collapsed floors approximately 7 floors down and did extensive damage and knocked out 2 beams. Therefore, what we're saying is instead of talking philosophy, let's talk reality. 1,300 pounds wouldn't have knocked down all of the columns that needed to be knocked down, which is the amount that Richard has said probably would be used to implode the building. Point number two, whenever an explosion goes off, it has a signature. If 1,000 pounds of explosive went off on one of the floors, it would be a completely different dust signature than what we've seen, which is lazy, curling, coming down. It would be shot out, straight out. All that you have to do is watch an explosion of a truck that unfortunately we see in Iraq, and you definitely see that. What I also want to point out is that the means of putting those explosives into place is simply not possible in a building that has between 50 and 100,000 people going in and out every day. It assumes that these super sleuths could come in, put shaped charges that have to be stood off from the beams a certain distance to accurately work, and they could do so without detection, which I think is a fantasy.
All right. Richard, go ahead. You've got 2 minutes.
Well, I think I addressed all of the points Ron just made previously, but what I want everybody to know is that it appears as if our government lied to us about these building collapses, and the 9/11 Commission reinforced that lie. FEMA and NIST obviously justified the lie, and the corporate media repeated and hammered in the lie. And we didn't have much of a chance, and that's why we didn't know the truth about 9/11. We have a lot of evidence that's come forth in just the last couple of years. It's very clear scientific evidence backed up by technical papers written by very credentialed people, all of which, or much of which, is on our website on the lower left side, underneath all of the media that people can look for. So it's essential that people wake up and realize that we're talking about, because Al-Qaeda did not have access to these highly secure buildings, obviously, we're not talking about a terrorist attack. We're talking about something that was clearly set up for some purpose, a very nefarious purpose that Americans need to wake up to. The evidence that we've talked about is just a small fraction of the body of information the 9/11 Truth Movement has assembled, and obviously the questions are numerous and they're ominous that must be investigated in a new investigation that the architects and engineers, who will number 1,000 by September 11th, 2008, that's my promise, we are demanding this new investigation, whether by Congress or private means, unimpeachable, with subpoena power, and the American people are growing in number who are aligned with us. Millions every year.
Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and Ron Craig, who is a member of the International Society of Explosives Engineers, I want to thank you both. Would you both be interested and available, say, for a part two of this somewhere down the road, and maybe in a couple of months?
Absolutely.
Richard?
Yeah, sure. I would love to. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, listen, and I want to thank you both for your arguments and your civility and sharing your points of view. And I think the one thing that all three of us would agree on is that there is a need for further investigation. Richard Gage, your website quickly?
AE911truth.org. That stands for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth.
All right. And Ron, not a website or anything to promote? Okay.
Nothing whatsoever.
All right. Well,
just the truth.
Okay. Thank you to you all. And back tomorrow night, or tonight rather, at 11 o'clock, The Secret History of the World and How to Get Out Alive. News is next with John Elson here on News Talk 1010 CFRB. Thanks, Dean. Thanks, Elliot. Thanks, Jade. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.